Go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And as you make your way there, I want to talk about one of my all-time favorite movies. I'm a big fan of historical movies, movies that bring the past to life in ways that you just can't get when you're reading a textbook or something like that. I'm also a big fan of historical movies that tell the viewers of the movie that about pieces of history you don't normally get. There's so much stuff in history that you just don't have time to get to when you're in grade school or junior high or high school or college. And so I like finding out about historical stories that I never knew about as when I was younger. And I know that somewhere in the past I have talked about the movie Seabiscuit for a message before, but since I can't remember the context of that message and how exactly I used it for the message, I'm going to use it here again, because I do know for sure that in my four and a half years here, I have never talked about David and Goliath as the main part of a message or even as a complementary part of it. So since David and Goliath is making its first appearance, I'll bring back Seabiscuit and that'll be all right. So the story of Seabiscuit is a David versus Goliath type story in American history. We are a country with a long history of supporting and cheering on the underdogs. We love seeing the little guy fight and win, even when the odds are stacked heavily against him. Surrounding the underdogs in a variety of circumstances are a cast of characters who usually also seem like unlikely participants in a grand and awe-inspiring story. That is the story of Seabiscuit, a horse in the 1930s that was treated very much like it was a punching bag kind of horse, a horse that was used to try and build up the confidence of other horses and help them get stronger to its own detriment. So this horse took all kinds of beatings along the way, and those beatings on Seabiscuit made Seabiscuit have an unruly and wild temperament. It was a horse that seemed very untamed in a lot of ways. Who wants to own a horse like that? Who wants to train a horse like that? And who wants to ride a horse like that? Well, these guys right here. This is the owner and the trainer and the rider. An unlikely cast of characters supporting and believing in the underdog. Owner Charles Howard, the one on your left, an entrepreneur, an automobile owner and distributor, and he's on the search for a secondary career as the economy collapsed and our world changed with the Great Depression. So he's looking for a new way out, and he decides he's just going to give this thoroughbred horse racing thing a try, something he'd never done before. Trainer Tom Smith, the one on the far right, a quiet guy with all sorts of odd ways. He preferred being around animals much more than being around people. And to be honest, there are days where I understand that completely. I would rather be with my cats all day instead of around people on some days. Writer Red Pollard, the small guy or smaller guy in the middle, an angry and a broken man holding on to the pain and resentment of his past. Separated and sent off by his family during the Great Depression because they couldn't afford to feed all of their kids, and so they sent their kids out all over the place. And because this kid loved to ride horses and seemed to be pretty successful at racing them, they sent him off with this group of people who were racing, doing races around the country. And so he was separated from his family as a young teenager. Not only was Red Pollard broken, but he was also too big to be a jockey by jockey standards. He was 5'7" and 115 pounds at a time when most jockeys were about 5 foot to 5'2" and maybe 100 pounds. And he was also partially blind in one eye, which is not a good thing to have as a horse rider. This motley crew shared one thing in common. They all saw something in the horse Seabiscuit that others just didn't see. When all was said and done, as far as the movie is concerned, Seabiscuit ends up winning an improbable one-on-one match race against a much larger horse called War Admiral. War Admiral was a Triple Crown horse, had that kind of a pedigree, and he actually sired future Triple Crown winners like American Pharoah and Justify. War Admiral had the best training facility and the best trainer and the best jockey that a wealthy career horse owner could buy. And yet, in the race between Seabiscuit and War Admiral, Seabiscuit won, and it wasn't even close. With that, let's go ahead and read from 1 Samuel chapter 17. Go ahead and stand with me as I read. I think I forgot to mention that Seabiscuit was actually a really, really small horse, especially in comparison to War Admiral. I'm going to read from 1 Samuel chapter 17, and I'm going to begin reading in verse 25 to 37. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight for him." Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy, and he has been fighting from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion came or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Go ahead and be seated. Now, as a little kid growing up in children's Sunday school, the story of David and Goliath is probably the very first underdog story I ever heard. And at that young age, even normal-sized adults seemed like giants to me. So for me as a little kid, trying to imagine a 9-foot-tall human being was just beyond the scope of my imagination, which made David's feat seem even more impressive. When I was in the 7th grade, I had a mind-altering experience that made the size of Goliath a little bit easier for me to envision. We had had a school trip. It was at the very end of, I think it was my 7th grade year, and they had a special trip that was for honor roll students or perfect attendance students. And so the kids that qualified by being on the honor roll or having perfect attendance got to go on this very, very special trip. The reward for those qualifying students was a trip to a Chicago Cubs game. And at the time, I was very excited because I had never been to any baseball game, much less a professional baseball game. And since I was younger, I didn't know that there was a much better Chicago team out there to root for. Go Chicago White Sox. It was at that only Cubs game that I have ever been to or will ever go to that I saw the tallest person I had ever met. In the 7th grade, I had just started watching basketball on television because I had just started playing basketball. And so anyways, I'm looking down and I'm seeing this monstrously tall guy. He was sitting in one row of box seats, but his feet were going over the seats in front of him and going all the way down to the floor of the row in front of them. His legs were that long. And as I said, I've been watching basketball around that time, and I've been watching the Chicago Bulls. And as I'm looking at this guy, I realize this guy was Will Perdue of the Chicago Bulls, their 7-foot center. And so me and some other friends, we took our little, you know, Chicago Cubs tickets. We thought we can have him sign our tickets. So we go over there and he stood up and he's signing these tickets. And the whole time I'm looking at him, I'm trying to imagine somebody 9 foot. If this is not, this is 7 foot tall, I can't even, you know, 9 foot tall guy is just humongous. And so I'm thinking about David and how in the world that must have felt like in the presence of a 9 foot giant. Someone even more intimidating because they're wearing armor instead of just jeans and a jacket like Will Perdue. What I have found is that reading through the story of David and Goliath as an adult is a very different experience than as a kid. While a guy that's 9 foot tall still sounds intimidating as an adult, it's not quite as intimidating as it was when I was a kid with my young ears. What amazes me now, actually, as I read this story, is the fact that for 40 days, there wasn't a grown man in that army with the perfect combination of bravery and stupidity to try and give that one a shot. We have people all the time now who want to try crazy things. I'm surprised nobody there thought that they were skillful enough or stealthy enough that they could avoid a death blow and maybe get a perfectly timed and perfectly placed stab of their own in there. After 40 days, there was no one in that army who was going to step forward. They were all afraid. But there's much more to it than I realized as a kid. As a kid, this story seemed to be, for me, more about not being afraid and being brave. But as I get older, the more I see about this is it's about faith. This is about having an unwavering confidence in God despite how bad things look, despite the optics of the situation. On the inside, David didn't have bravery. He had something else. He had faith. And that faith moved him to act in ways that our world would call brave. More than just being afraid of Goliath, the entire army of Israel lacked confidence in God, confidence that God would help them be victorious over their enemy. Their fear did not just reflect on them personally, but it reflected on their view of God. This was about faith in God, and the Israel army didn't have it. For 40 days, they lacked faith, and it was on full display. Many years later, that lack of faith by the people of Israel was still a problem, and we see it manifested in the disciples of Jesus. The Gospel of Matthew highlights the issue of faith in very pointed and impossible to deny ways. Time and again, throughout the book of Matthew, we see that Jesus' disciples are being called out time and again as those of little faith. While at the very same time, Jesus keeps pointing out faith in people that are unexpected people, surprising people. To a Roman centurion, an astonished Jesus says, "I have not found such great faith in all of Israel." Israel should have been a community of people with tremendous faith in their God, but repeatedly they fell short. In Matthew chapter 17, we have a situation that I think perfectly complements this David and Goliath story that we've read in the Old Testament. So I'm going to go ahead and read that now. It's from Matthew chapter 17, and it's verses 14 through 21. This comes on the tail end of numerous accounts where Jesus calls the disciples the ones with little faith, and numerous accounts where Jesus refers to other people as having great faith. This comes after Jesus has given the disciples all kinds of power to go out and do exactly what he's going to talk about here. Chapter 17, beginning in verse 14. When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. "Lord, have mercy on my son," he said. "He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him." "O unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me." Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed from that moment. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" Which was a legitimate question for them to ask, because Jesus had specifically given them the power to go out and cast out demons. Jesus replied, "Because you have so little faith. I tell you the truth, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." There are a couple really, really important takeaways from this small passage in Matthew 17, things that I think help shed additional light on David and Goliath. The first takeaway is that when it comes to faith, the size of the problem is actually pretty insignificant. While a 9-foot man may feel imposing, a 9-foot man is nothing compared to the size of a mountain. And what we just read is that when it comes to a size of a mountain, faith can tell that massive mountain to move from here to there. When it comes to faith, the size of the problem doesn't matter. And yet, how often do God's people respond to obstacles in proportion to the size of the problem? The bigger the problem, the more we talk about it. The bigger the problem, the more we worry about it. The bigger the problem, the more we doubt that God's actually going to do something about it. All the while, Scripture tells us that the size of any problem we may encounter in this life is insignificant because our God is greater, our God is stronger, our God is higher than any other. Those aren't just words to a song, those are the gospel truth. There is nothing that is too big for God to handle. The second takeaway is that the size of a person's faith is also insignificant. The disciples' situation is not a situation where the size of a person's faith determines what kind of obstacles they can overcome. This is not a situation where you only need a little bit of faith for small challenges and an even bigger sized faith for bigger challenges. When it comes to faith, the size of faith does not matter. If you ever hear a Christian tell another person that they just need to have more faith in the face of their challenges, please do me a favor and step in and tell them that they are wrong. Even if it's a pastor saying that, it just isn't true. Faith does not come in sizes, and this passage makes it clear that the smallest amount of faith can do the impossible. If you have faith, you have enough faith. No greater, larger faith is needed. The problem encountered by the army of Israel and the problems encountered later by Jesus' disciples every time they were called out as those of little faith was not that they needed to have more faith. The problem they were all facing in Matthew chapter 17 and 1 Samuel 17 is rooted in the fact that things like fear choke the life and power out of faith. When Jesus tells the parable of the sower in Matthew chapter 14, he talks about a seed falling among thorns. The seed grows up, but pretty soon the worries of this life choke the life out of the plant, making it unfruitful. That is what seeds, weeds, and thorns do. They choke the life out of plants that are intended to be fruitful. While we may tend to think of fear and worry as separate emotional experiences, fear is actually the foundation emotion that manifests itself in a variety of ways. Fear can manifest itself as being scared, insecure, nervous, worried. All of those emotions have a degree of fear fueling them, and those are the emotions that grow up alongside faith and start to choke it. Those are the vines that start to rob faith of its power. Right now, at this very second, along the very back fence line of the house, there is a work project I need to get busy on soon because I've got vines, little vines that start growing up around the daylilies. Right now, they don't seem to be a problem, but if I were to let them go, they start to pull in and restrict the movement of those plants, and if they pull in tight enough, they'll start to damage the leaves of the daylilies. What I need to do is go out there and pull those vines up by the root. At some point, I probably tore off the top, but I didn't get the root, and so they keep coming back. What I need to do is pull them up by the roots so that they won't. For anyone wanting their faith to be powerful and fruitful, the same thing needs to be done with their fears. Pull them up by the root before they disable your faith and get in the way of seeing God do impossible things. When it comes to fear, there are only two fears that you are born with. Two fears that are innate. Are there any guesses as to what those two fears are that you're born with as a little baby? Any guesses at all? Here's what they are. The fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. Both of those things will startle any newborn baby. But anything else outside of that are not fears that they're born with. They're fears that they inherit from their experiences or inherit from others. Every other fear is learned in some sort of way. If you have a negative experience with something, you store that in the memory banks, and that stored memory can elicit fear. Get bit by a dog, and you may develop a fear of dogs. Nobody's ever had a bad experience with cats, so I'll skip past that. Cats are wonderful. Have a bad experience in a pool, and you may develop a strong fear of deep water. If allowed to, fear can start to shape the boundaries of a person's life fairly quickly and even at a young age. Boundaries that then become the restrictive limits for what a person will or won't do with their faith. Fear chips away at faith, which is probably why one of the most recurring messages throughout Scripture from beginning to end is do not be afraid. It's a message that's repeated loud and clear from God to his people. Don't be afraid. And the reason God has to keep saying that in a variety of ways is because God's people have this habit of always being afraid of something, and those fears getting in the way of God's people doing and being what they are called to be and do. It's a message that the church needs to hear loud and clear today. If I could point out a single recurring common denominator in many Christian conversations when Christians are talking about our world, it would have to be fear. Christians may try to dress it up and make it look prettier by calling it concern, but underneath that concern is fear. And since we're only born with two innate fears, someone has to ask, where did the church get all of these fears from? The answer is pretty clear as I see it. The church has been consuming the fears that have been arriving prepackaged on her doorstep. The very same fear-based conversations happening outside the church are the very same fear-based conversations happening in the church. Fear is how this world works. If you scare people, you have the ability to steer people. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, there are media platforms willing and able to keep you in a persistent, steady state of fear. That's also a good way to maintain loyal viewership. So long as there's always something you need to be worried about, there is always a reason to watch. You don't want to miss a day because you may miss out on something else you should be worried about. Under the guise of keeping people informed, they are doing so much more than that. A great way for Christians to disarm fear in their lives might be to turn off the television and avoid all of the fear-mongering clickbait that happens online and on television. I'm so glad that I have two jobs that actually keep me busy, so I actually watch very, very little television, and I don't miss it one bit. The last thing I need is to have something telling me what I need to be fearful about heading into each and every new day. David was a young boy. He hadn't yet inherited the fears that other people might want to pass on to him. Instead of fear, he had an unwavering confidence that no matter the obstacle, God was more than capable to deliver him. Perhaps the absence of most fear in little kids is why Jesus tells his disciples that they need to become like little children. There are so many things that I did as a kid that I wouldn't dream of doing now. As an adult, I can look at a particular situation and see 100 different ways where that can go bad and land me in a hospital. So I just avoid it altogether. As a child, I spent zero time thinking about the possible repercussions of the many things I did. And it's probably a good thing that I only went to the hospital as many times as I did. I think I went about 9 times, stitches and things like that. But it could have been so much worse. As David starts toward his encounter with Goliath, Saul wants to help him out as best as he can. If David is going to have any chance at all of winning, he is going to need what Saul has. I'm going to read 1 Samuel 17, just verses 38 through 40. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I am not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. Maybe you've heard the saying, never bring a knife to a gunfight. generally speaking, a person with a knife doesn't stand much of a chance against a person with a gun. Saul and others, I'm sure, were looking at this young man with no armor and a little sling in his hand, thinking, there's no way that this is going to end well. Not just for David, but for the whole army of Israel, because if David lost, they would become the property of the Philistines. For those trained in the art of worldly war and combat, they knew what David needed, but they were wrong. David resisted their efforts. He didn't need their help. He didn't need their weapons. This is why I'm not a fan of worldly politics. Politicians spend their time not just telling their constituents who and what to be afraid of, but they also offer up the advice on what we need heading into battle. The political messaging that I see being presented to the church resembles Saul placing a helmet on David's head, armor on his chest, and a sword in his hand. Church, you're going to need this if you're going to be successful in your mission. You're going to need legislative power. Here's your sword. You're going to need judicial power. Here's your breastplate. You're going to need presidential power. Here's your helmet. That message is garbage, absolute garbage. The church looks awkward when it's covered from head to toe in political attire. The church looks awkward when it's wielding a political weapon of this world instead of the weapons God has given us. The church can't move through this world as smoothly as it should when it's being held down and held back by something that wasn't fitted for the church to wear. The weapons we fight with as citizens of God's kingdom are not of this world because the mission of this church is not of this world either. One of the ways that we show an unwavering confidence in our God is we resist the efforts of those kingdoms of this world trying to put things in our hands and put things in our heads. When we resist the temptation of others to put a weapon in our hand and their fears in our minds and tell us where we need to go to fight. The confidence of the church needs to be in God and in God alone. When you've dealt with the fear and you've pulled it up by the roots, resisting those temptations is so much easier. May the church resemble a young David. When you are free from fear and you have an unwavering confidence in God, the Goliaths in this world don't look so intimidating. Goliath is nothing compared to a mountain, and the God who is with us formed those mighty mountains with his hands. With that powerful God on our side, who needs any weapon of this world? No weapon formed against us will stand. Whom then shall we fear? May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. This morning, we're going to sing that opening song, because as we're singing, I'm like, well, that's where my message ends. This would be a great song to end with. And so we're going to finish with that song this morning. As we sing this morning, I don't know what kinds of challenges you may be facing in life. I don't have access to everybody's life in that way. I don't know what elicits fear or concern or worry or anxiety in your life. But whatever it is, in whatever form it may be, what I need you to do this morning is envision that fear-evoking thing, whatever it is, put a name on it and put it on Goliath. Put that worry, concern, fear, put it on his helmet, put it on his breastplate, maybe have the little shield carrier in front of him waving a banner that has the name of whatever it is that elicits fear on it. And then do this. Put a massive, massive mountain in the backdrop. A massive mountain in the backdrop where when you're looking at Goliath with a different name on it based on whatever it is you may have, you can't see him without seeing this mountain behind it. A visible reminder of the power of our God. A faith that can move mountains will have no problem with anything in your path. With a faith like that, you can even sing a song in the midst of life's challenges. So this morning, go ahead and stand as we sing.